This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the transition to a Biden administration is officially underway. How will President-elect Biden's new team of diplomatic and national security officials deal with the challenges left by U.S. President Donald Trump? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Barely 1 week after the U.S. presidential election, President Trump, who has yet to officially concede, fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Several days later, Esper's successor, Christopher Miller, the fourth official to lead the Pentagon under Mr. Trump, announced a troop drawdown in Afghanistan with plans to reduce the overall numbers of U.S. troops to 2,500 by early 2021. Analysts say the Taliban seems to be portraying the announcement of the U.S. troop drawdown as part of its narrative claiming victory over the United States. President Trump is ordering a reduction of 500 troops from Iraq. This week, President-elect Joe Biden has introduced the individuals he plans to nominate for top foreign policy and national security posts in his administration. The group includes Antony Blinken, one of Biden's closest foreign affairs advisors, as the choice for Secretary of State. In addition, he has nominated Alejandro Mayorkas to be Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Avril Haines to be Director of National Intelligence, Linda Thomas-Greenfield to be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Jake Sullivan to be National Security Advisor, and John Kerry to be Special Presidential Envoy for Climate. Once these appointees are confirmed by the U.S. Senate, how will they deal with the legacy of the Trump administration? How will the U.S. posture change, especially vis-a-vis U.S. policy in the Middle East? Well, joining us to analyze these important questions are two distinguished regional analysts. Ellen Lapson is professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. Previously, she held senior national security positions in the U.S. government and served as CEO of the Stimson Center. And Kenneth Pollack, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, that's a policy group here in Washington. He works on Middle Eastern political military affairs. Before joining AEI, Ken Pollack was affiliated with the Brookings Institution, where he was a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy. He also served twice at the National Security Council. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams. Ellen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Carol. I'm glad to be with you.
And Ken Pollack, it's a pleasure to have you back as well.
Thank you. Pleasure for me to be here.
Ellen, let me go first to you to talk about the troop drawdown in Afghanistan. Now, this move has been criticized by U.S. and NATO military commanders, in addition to many Republican and Democratic lawmakers, as precipitous. They argue, especially NATO Secretary General, that the price for leaving too soon or in an uncoordinated fashion could be high. How do you interpret this announcement by Mr. Trump?
Well, it's clear that the military are quite uncomfortable with the president's decision, which is to essentially accelerate a process that was already underway, but very carefully negotiated, first with the Taliban and now hopefully with a process that brings both the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan together in some kind of a formal dialogue. Basically, the president's proposal is, I believe, somewhat politically motivated to demonstrate that he followed through on his pledge to get out of these endless wars, the phrase he's used. But what he's done is he's accelerated a process that is essentially not necessarily important to the diplomatic and political goal of trying to get the United States out of Afghanistan with some semblance of dignity and with a policy that we could essentially have a narrative that we chose to leave. We did not win the war in terms of bringing all of the objectives we had of bringing stability and better governance to Afghanistan. But most importantly, it gives a sort of unnecessary extra victory to the Taliban. I mean, here they are in the catbird seat because they've been the ones to negotiate the withdrawal of American forces, very much undermining the psychology and even the appearance of political legitimacy of the government in Kabul. Pulling over 2,000 American troops out even faster than originally planned only weakens the government in Kabul further. And I think it is possible that if this withdrawal is achieved in the time frame that President Trump has given the military, it will only undermine the government in Kabul and make that delicate negotiation between the Taliban and the government even harder and possibly bring it to a halt.
What is the reaction by the Afghan government?
Yeah, so while Ambassador Khalilzad negotiated with the Taliban, the government in Kabul was quite furious. I mean, they really already felt that the United States had almost betrayed them, even though our objective was to do anything possible to put in place a political process that would bring some level of reconciliation. One cannot ignore that the Taliban have made themselves a player in Afghan politics, and the country cannot be stable without at least a conversation with the Taliban about security conditions in the country. So, you know, we are now at odds with our client, if you will, President Ashraf Ghani in Kabul. Everything that has happened in the last few months has worked to only alienate him from the United States. So it's quite messy. And while the Biden administration may agree with the principle that it is time to get out of Afghanistan and that we're not going to be able to wrap this up with a pretty bow and say, didn't we do a great job? Nonetheless, the way it's done only adds to the diplomatic challenge to the new administration.
Turning to you, Ken Pollack, with respect to Iraq, do you think that the drawdown of 500 troops in Iraq will equally hamstring the incoming Biden administration? What's your take on the drawdown in Iraq?
I certainly think that it's unhelpful. I don't think that it's going to be as unhelpful, as problematic as Ellen described it for Afghanistan. I think she's absolutely right about Afghanistan. But, you know, in Iraq, it perpetuates this pattern that we have seen for years and years in Iraq of playing games with troop numbers based on what politicians think will play best in terms of American domestic politics. And I think the truth of the matter is, I don't think the American public really cares whether we have 1,000 troops in Iraq or 10,000 troops in Iraq. They care about casualties. They care about whether those troops are actually making a difference. Right? And there, the troops still have a real purpose in Iraq. They're there to train the Iraqi military. They are there to keep a lid and to finish off ISIS and other terrorist groups. They're there to prevent the Iranians from taking over Iraq. Those are all very important missions. And I think that if you were to ask American military commanders, and you could get them to speak openly about it, I think they'd all tell you that the right number for those missions is probably somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 troops. But nevertheless, we continue to just shave off troops and shave off troops gratuitously so that different presidents can claim that they've done something meaningful. And again, all it does, it doesn't change the public's perception of that presence in Iraq. All it does is make it harder for our troops in Iraq to get their job done. And potentially, you know, we could find ourselves in another situation exactly as we did in 2014, where again, we made a decision to pull troops out largely for domestic political reasons and only to find that it was a disaster. And we had to go back and recommit and send more troops. So is reducing the presence in Iraq by 500 troops all that meaningful? No, it isn't. But it's certainly disheartening to our military personnel and others who kind of look at American policy toward Iraq that we're continuing to play these games rather than asking, what do we need to get the job done?
Ken Pollack, how does the Iraqi government view this announcement?
They're not wild about it, but they recognize that it could be a lot worse. They know that President Trump would have loved to have been able to tell his constituency, I got everybody out of Iraq altogether. Cutting the presence by just 500 troops really isn't a very big deal. They don't like the symbolism of it, but they recognize that keeping the vast majority, keeping 2,500 troops in Iraq, was far more important than reducing it by 500.
Ellen Lapson, let's take a look at the Biden national security team that was just rolled out. I'd love to get your perspective on this national security foreign policy team and how they will differ from the Trump administration.
So first of all, I think these are serious, competent people who know how the government works. They will work well together. So very strong in terms of their familiarity with Biden. But if we take as a premise that Biden expects to spend 80% of his time on domestic issues between COVID and the economy, you know, racial and social injustice, polarization, et cetera, he needs a team that he really knows well and trusts, and I think he's achieved that.
Ken Pollack, what's your take on the new Biden foreign policy national security team?
I think she's absolutely right. This is an extremely experienced team. It is a very competent team. It is a very smart team. I will also add, and this is kind of piggybacking off of Ellen's point, it's a very centrist team. And I think that there were lots of folks on the right who were terrified that we were going to get a bunch of socialists coming in. That's clearly not the case. And I never expected it would be because, of course, that's not who Joe Biden is, right? And as Ellen nicely pointed out, Biden clearly is picking people that he likes, that he trusts, that reflect how he sees the world, right? And in that point, it's also important to note that there were lots of people who either hoped or feared that Joe Biden was going to be a third term for President Obama. I always thought that that was a mistake because people always expect that. It's never the case, right? The vice presidents who become presidents, they are always who they want to be. George H.W. Bush, Richard Nixon, I mean, we can go all the way back if he wants it. And I think that's what Joe Biden is doing. As Ellen points out, the economy and the pandemic are going to consume easily 80% of this administration's time, energy, and political capital. And so the group that has to deal with foreign policy is going to have a lot of work to do without a whole lot of tools with which to do it.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ellen Lapson. She's professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Ken Pollack. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. We're discussing President Trump's proposal to draw down U.S. troops from Afghanistan and Iraq and what impact this and other policies may have on the incoming Biden administration. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a big shout out to a fan and listener from Islamabad, Pakistan, Malak Izaz Saib. If you want to hear your name and home country on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program and our discussion of foreign policy, particularly toward the Middle East. Back to you, Ellen Lapson. What about your take on how the U.S. policy will differ under a Biden administration than from the Trump administration, particularly because some analysts argue that President Trump's most positive foreign policy legacy will lie in the greater Middle East, formalization of agreements between Israel and three Arab states, overrunning the Islamic State territory in Syria and Iraq. But on the other hand, you know, he withdrew from the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. There are a number of challenges. President-elect Biden has said that he would like to rejoin the JCPOA, but it's not going to be so simple. What are the challenges for the new administration vis-a-vis Iran?
So I quite agree that Iran is going to be the hardest problem for President-elect Biden because it is true that it was an Obama legacy to have this extraordinary diplomatic achievement of that joint comprehensive plan of action that was signed by six countries and Iran in 2015. And it was hard-fought battle to get formal approval of the JCPOA. And I think Biden, in his heart, believes that we should at least go back as much as we can to the assumptions and provisions of that accord. But lots of complicating factors of how do you get the U.S. back in compliance? How do you get the Iranians back in compliance? How do you add the missing pieces of Iran's behavior in regional wars and conflicts and certainly Iran's missile developments that were never part of the 2015 agreement. Very tricky, lots of legal arguments about whether the agreement is still in existence and therefore we can just rejoin it, or I personally think trying to renegotiate a new agreement may be just too hard. But let's also just flag a couple of points of continuity. I think that from Obama through Trump to Biden, there is a desire to make the Middle East less central in U.S. national security concerns. There will still, I assume, be both a robust civilian and military presence in the region. But I hear among the Biden advisors some greater tolerance for, you know, well, the Russians can play a constructive role and we're not going to go to war with China over the Middle East, and a bit of a tolerance that the region will be a multipolar environment and more regional ownership of regional problems. So I do see a somewhat less ambitious American profile in the region. And having said that, I think President Biden will very much enjoy reestablishing personal relations with the leaders in the region, and they're all perfectly happy to work with him, including Israel. The one outlier might be Saudi Arabia, because if we take Biden's human rights interest, his democracy interests, and his fretting over the Saudi, you know, Khashoggi affair, Saudi Arabia in Yemen, et cetera, that relationship may be a little more tense than it's been under President Trump.
That's a terrific overview. So over to you, Ken Pollack, for your take. Now, President-elect Biden can rejoin the WHO and the Paris Climate Accord pretty much from day one, but it's not going to be so easy to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. What is your take about the challenges regarding U.S. policy toward Iran? And even though the United States, as Ellen said, may want to have a certain amount of continuity between Obama, Trump, and Biden, maybe a less higher profile in the Middle East, pivoting more to East Asia, nonetheless, we have challenges and important ones that we need to address as the United States in the region. I'd like to get your take on those.
Sure. I think that's absolutely right, Carol. Let me peel back the onion on Iran another layer beyond where Ellen started us off, because, you know, I think that there is a widespread perception that this isn't going to be hard, right? The U.S. will come back into the JCPOA, and the assumption is that the Iranians are going to welcome that because it's an opportunity to get rid of the, you know, very severe sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. And Americans just assume, we have this bad habit of mirror imaging, the Iranians and the Iranian leadership will care about their economy first and foremost, exactly the way that we would, and that this will be their priority. And I think that that's very problematic as we think about Iran because of the domestic political changes that have taken place in Iran as a result of Trump's approach to Iran. So very quickly, because this is enormously complex. The agreement, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear agreement, was struck between the Obama administration and a group of relative moderates in the Iranian regime. President Hassan Rouhani and Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, these are people who believe in a better relationship with the United States. And against the opposition of Iran's hardliners, they convinced Iran's supreme leader to go ahead, make the deal with the United States in the assumption that the U.S. would lift the sanctions. This would revive Iran's economy. It would make their people happy, and the Iranian regime would benefit accordingly. Iran's hardliners fought this tooth and nail. They didn't want to end their nuclear program. They didn't want a better relationship with the United States. And what they consistently argued was the Americans will cheat, they will renege on the deal, and by the way, the deal is too favorable to the Americans to begin with. So when President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the JCPOA, it was seen in Iran as complete confirmation and validation of the hardline position. And what we've seen over the last 2-3 years is that Rouhani and Zarif and other more pragmatic and moderate Iranian politicians have been running for the hills. They are on the defensive. The hardliners are very much in control. And the foreign policy we've been seeing from Iran is a hardline foreign policy. We're going to have elections, presidential elections in Iran in June of next year. I think it highly likely that we will get a hardliner replacing Rouhani as Iran's president. And what we've consistently heard from the hardliners, including on several occasions from the supreme leader himself, is he's not interested in negotiating with the United States. He's not interested in coming back to the nuclear deal because his argument is the Americans cheat, they lie, the deal wasn't good enough for us to begin with. Why on earth should we trust the Americans again? And I think there are a lot of Americans who just assume that's a bargaining position. Maybe he's holding out to get a better deal. But I think that we need to recognize that that actually represents very accurately where Iran's hardliners are, probably where Khamenei is himself, and that they are very much in the driver's seat. And for all of these reasons, I think the Biden administration could have a very difficult time bringing the Iranians back into the nuclear deal. And that is going to make dealing with Iran a whole lot harder, because I think there's no question what they're really hoping, even though they know it is going to be tough, is that they can convince the Iranians to just forget about the last 4 years, go back to 2015-16. They come back into their compliance requirements under the JCPOA. We lift the sanctions, and we just all forget about the last 4 years. And I think, unfortunately, the last 4 years have dramatically dramatically changed Iran's domestic politics in a way that's going to make it very hard for us to do that, which then, as you were pointing out before, also makes it hard for the U.S. to say, you know what, we're going to play less of a role in the Middle East. There's less to worry about there. We can concentrate on other parts of the world instead. There's a widespread misperception that America's allies, the Israelis, the Saudis, the Emiratis, loved the Trump administration. They don't. They didn't. They felt betrayed by the Trump administration, which talked a good game and allowed them to do more or less what they wanted, but gave them no support. And they found that terrifying and an incredible betrayal. And there will be a lot of room for a Biden administration to come back in and say, we'd like to go back to a more traditional American approach. We are going to support you. But of course, that's where things get tricky, because as you and Ellen have both pointed out, we're not going to go back to the George W. Bush era or even the Clinton era, let alone the George H.W. Bush era, where the United States was making the Middle East one of its primary regions of focus and willing to invest lots of resources and political capital. So that's going to be a trick for the Biden administration, is how do we start to rebuild those relationships and convince our allies that we really are going to support them without getting overcommitted the way that we have in the past.
Ellen, we have very little time, but I wanted to ask you if you would like to comment on what Ken just said, but also with respect to the Israelis and the Palestinians, the legacy that President Trump has left behind. He has backed this anti-Iran alliance, bringing together Israel and Arab states. We saw the signing of three diplomatic accords between Israel and the UAE, Bahrain, and then Sudan. How do you think the Biden administration can repair relations? But also, to what extent will President-elect Biden build on what President Trump left behind with respect to these deals, or maybe diverge from them, particularly with respect to Israel, where many analysts say the United States has gone too far to defend the Bibi Netanyahu administration?
I think that the Abraham Accords, the three normalization agreements, and probably the moving of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, the Biden folks are just going to say, fine, that's the new reality, in a positive way, too, that Israel normalizing relations with additional Arab countries is good, it's positive, maybe economic and scientific cooperation can take place, that's all good. But it misses the point that the strategic intervention by the Trump administration to tilt the balance even further, saying that Israel's security is paramount and that, you know, the natural rights of the Palestinian people are somehow of very secondary, if not tertiary importance. That's going to be very hard for the Biden administration to decide how much time and investment do they want to spend walking that back. I think some real damage has been done that uproots what were decades of carefully crafted American policies on these issues. So I think there's very little prospect for a complete turnaround in Arab-Israeli things. And the Trump administration, in the end, had the consolation prize of the Abraham Accords, but failed to achieve its much vaunted greater Middle East peace plan.
Last word to you, Ken.
Again, just to tack on a point, what we really need to keep sight of here is that everyone is talking about the Abraham Accords as potentially being the end of the Arab-Israeli conflict and how wonderful that would be. And it would be a wonderful thing. But there are two issues out there we need to keep in mind. One, as Ellen was alluding to, the Palestinians are still there and they're still miserable and they still are living in limbo. And that situation needs to be dealt with for the good of the Palestinians, needs to be dealt with for the good of Israelis, and ultimately for the stability of that part of the world. And second, you know, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that if you want to talk about the contribution of the Trump administration to the Abraham Accords, again, it was the Trump administration ultimately abandoning our allies in the region, particularly the Emirates and the Saudis, who, if you remember, were attacked repeatedly and egregiously by the Iranians all throughout 2019. That was absolutely terrifying to the Saudis and the Emiratis. They realized that the United States, at least under Donald Trump, was no longer going to help them against Iran. They needed to find someone else to do so. And they decided that if you couldn't have the U.S., the Israelis were perhaps the next best thing. The problem is that ultimately we need to recognize this is a war coalition. As much good as may come of it, this is really about the Israelis and the Sunni Arab states gearing up for a potential war against Iran. That would not be good for the Middle East, for our allies, or for us.
On that note, I'm afraid that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ellen Lapson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Kenneth Pollitt, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.